Pat Metheny Group recorded live somewhere. Recorded live somewhere. No denying it. Actually, here's the test for you. Do you know where that was?
Sacramento, California.
Oh, very good. And even if it wasn't true, you said it so convincingly, who could doubt it? That song's called Song for Bill Bow. This is interesting. I'll just ask questions here, and you can play with the tape.
Okay.
So, you mentioned earlier that you had also, after having done a three-month European dalliance, you came back here for 10 seconds, then went back to London to work on a film score. Why don't you talk a little bit about that one?
Okay.
That's actually a process that's been in the works for a while.
Yeah. The name of the movie is Under Fire, and it's a movie that is going to be out in October. It stars Nick Nolte and Gene Hackman, and it's pretty interesting and very timely in that it's about Nicaragua and the political situation down there from the point of view of a news reporter who was in Nicaragua in the 3 or 4 weeks just prior to the fall of the Somoza regime in 1979. And there's, you know, it's kind of a docudrama format in the sense that, you know, there's kind of a love story in there too, but I mean that's where it takes place, and it deals with the whole question of the Sandinistas and all that stuff. So I was interested in it from that standpoint initially. I mean, we've had a number of offers to do movies and be involved in different films, and we get the scripts, and 9 times out of 10 they're something sort of along the lines of Porky's or something like that. You know, I mean, I wasn't really too hot to get involved in anything unless it was going to be really hip and something I could, you know, get behind. So this fit in that standpoint. And so, you know, we went out there and met with those people, and it ended up that, you know, we weren't really qualified to do the score. And I mean, I see that more clearly now, having gone through the whole process with somebody who really knows what he's doing, like Jerry Goldsmith. I know that now more than ever. It's not something you can just kind of casually walk into. And so the producer was very interested in having me involved somehow or another. So what ended up happening is that Jerry Goldsmith wrote the music, and I'm kind of featured as a guitar soloist throughout the whole thing, throughout the score and also on the album. I'm playing a lot, you know. But the interesting part about it for me was that I was there for a month and I didn't touch the electric guitar once. In fact, I didn't even touch a pick. I mean, it was like a classical guitar gig straight down the line with, you know, a little Spanish kind of influence. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that, and I especially enjoyed the feeling of playing acoustic music again with acoustic musicians. I mean, there were no microphones or anything in the room. I mean, from an amplifying standpoint,
right.
Anywhere, you know, there were recording microphones, but you know, you had to get a natural balance, and that was really great therapy for me. I mean, since I am so involved in electric music and enthusiastically so, I mean, my enthusiasm hasn't waned at all in that department, but I mean, it's really refreshing after twiddling knobs and dealing with digital delays and this and that and this and that for years to just have to sit there with an instrument in your hand and that be the whole thing. So probably more than anything, that was the most exciting part about it for me. And also, I have to say that Jerry Goldsmith is an unbelievable musician. I mean, I really was a fan of his anyway from before, from the soundtracks that we've mentioned earlier. But I mean, this guy is serious. You know, I mean, it's more than just that he's a good craftsman at it. I mean, he's a real soulful musician.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to being that, he's also got his craft together so that he doesn't even have to think twice. And I mean, you know, for people who maybe don't know exactly what I'm talking about, you know, there's some areas that I wasn't even that aware of before, but like this thing of being able to write music that goes on underneath dialogue. I mean, that's a whole art form in itself that, you know, I really had no sense of before. In fact, in a way, the whole process makes it difficult for me to just sort of watch a movie or TV now in kind of a civilian way. I mean, it's like I'm so aware of all these little details that I wasn't aware of before that it's really changed my whole point of view on how that whole thing works.
So this recording process was also largely live, right? There wasn't the chance to...
Yeah, that's another interesting thing, is that, you know, it's all done direct to three-track mag, they call it. In other words, you know, like on a film, there's like the film, and then there's a soundtrack film that goes right along with it. And, you know, a lot of film scores are done, you know, like a normal recording process would be, in the sense that they record a 24-track and then they go back later and mix it down and then put it on this 3-track mag. But, you know, of course, you add a few generations in there. And for music that's going to be real powerful in the dynamic department, in other words, you know, some real soft stuff followed by some real loud stuff, they obviously want to keep the signal-to-noise ratio as broad as possible. And so in Jerry's case, he prefers to do everything direct, live to this 3-track mag, right, center, and left, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, everything was live. I mean, it was me and the London Symphony. And, you know, you just can't mess up. I mean, you have to play it right.
Plus, you were doing, I mean, this was mostly reading you were doing, right? It wasn't like, here's A minor, do a B flat major.
And it was almost all written out. And had to play some mandolin in it, quite a bit of mandolin, actually.
Oh, yeah?
And, you know,
have you ever played mandolin before?
Never had. In fact, the very first cue when we sat down, I mean, I was kind of nervous anyway, because here's all these old London Symphony guys, you know, who are like jaded beyond belief, you know, having done a million of these things, and I'm sitting there, you know, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and everything, and he calls this first cue, you know. And I look up the top, and it says tipple on it, you know, which I figured that was, you know, my legit chops were down a little bit. I mean, as far as, you know, remembering what, you know, mezzo, you know, this and that and all those Italian terms. So I figured, well, it's a tipple on it. I figured that must mean like fast or something like that. But as it turned out, it meant to play this weird 3-string Nicaraguan instrument. And and they had one there, and so I said, gee, okay, I'll try it. And I tuned it, you know, I cheated, I guess. I mean, it was supposed to be tuned in fifths, but I mean, that would have been hopeless for me. So I tuned it kind of like a guitar and transposed it a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it sounds okay. It sounds sort of funky. I mean, it sounds like kind of drunk Nicaraguan guy playing it, and I think that's the effect that they wanted. But, it was really a challenge. I mean, I'll tell you, I never worked so hard in my life. I mean, there was a lot of stuff to do, and lots of sessions. And
you didn't have much time to prepare the stuff beforehand either. Would he like give you the music the night before, and you'd go to your room and practice?
Sometimes. There's one thing that's basically like a guitar concerto that's got all these wild time changes and everything. I got that the day before, but this is another thing that freaked me out, is that he got to London a week before the first session, like I did, and he hadn't written a note. I mean, he hadn't written anything. You know, he had the two basic themes, and he just cranked it out. And, I mean, he has a whole team that he brings with him, an orchestrator, a music editor, a copyist. It's like, you know, Jerry Goldsmith Incorporated, you know.
Right.
And when you hire him to do a score, he's got his whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, these guys are together. I mean, it was amazing. The music editor that he uses is the guy that did E.T. He's done all John Williams stuff. And, you know, that's one of those things. I mean, I've seen music editor in credits for years. And, I mean, I had no idea what that meant.
What does it mean?
Yeah, it's weird. Well, there's this guy that has to prepare click tracks for the orchestra that go along with the exact points in the film where certain things happen. In other words, when Jerry... The first thing that happens is that they get together with the director, Jerry, and the music editor, and they spot the film. They say, okay, you know, at this point we need music, you know, at, you know, minute 26, you know, second 43 9/10, from there until minute 29, you know, we need this kind of music. And the music editor's job is then to come up with a click track at whatever tempo the composer says that everybody listens to, that then syncs up with the film afterwards. Now, in the case of Jerry, he never writes any two bars in a row in the same time signature. I mean, also, all the things that you hear that are rubato or sound kind of out of time,
mm-hmm,
are all in time. I mean, that was another thing that freaked me out, is that, you know, you think that...
Well, it wasn't just him sort of cueing.
No, it's all in time. And, like, so he writes in, by way of odd time signatures, all kinds of, you know... feel changes and accelerandos and, you know, everything. It's all written in. And the clicks have to correspond to that.
Oh my God.
So, like, for instance, this one tune, this guitar concerto kind of tune, it's like a bar of 3/8 followed by a bar of 5/8 followed by a bar of 4/4 followed by a bar of 7/8. So what you hear in your headphones are these clicks going click, 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 click. I mean, that would be hard enough. But on top of that,
there's the strings that don't show up for half an hour, right?
Are like, you know, literally a half a beat to a beat behind constantly. But they're all completely together. So, I mean, I remember the first time with one of these odd time signature things that I went up to listen to a playback. It sounded like I was, you know, on speed or something relative to the strings, even though I know I was hitting each click exactly right, like any kind of jazz or rock and roll musician would. So then I had to get into sort of ignoring the click, which was really hard, but at the same time staying with it, but way behind it.
Keeping it steady, but not with it.
Yeah, so it was hard.
Plus the conductor's conducting with the click, right?
Well, I mean, Jerry was conducting, and I mean, I finally just got to the point where I just couldn't even look, because, I mean, what he does is he conducts way ahead of the click.
Just to get the strings close.
Right. So, in other words, he's, like, frantically beating way on top of the beat. Strings are playing way behind the beat. And, you know, it's just, like, complete chaos to me. You know?
It is. It's weird. It's because the click is there, but nobody's really – it's like it's a reference point that nobody's using.
Exactly. It was really wild. And also part of my duties in this particular project were to come up with a few what they call source cues, where, you know, there's like a radio playing in the background, you know, that's got disco music, or there was one scene where there's a party going on and they needed like 2 minutes of sort of like 1979 party music, you know. So I did that, and then there was another scene like in an elevator where they need to hear some kind of like jazzy instrumental, pop instrumental, like way off in the background. So in a way that was fun too, because I got some free studio time and got to go in there and kind of mess around with this elaborate 24-track thing to, you know, come up with something that, I mean,
did you just do it all yourself, or did you use...
Yeah, I'd use the synclavier and the drum machine and some guitars. I played a little bass, you know, too. And you end up hearing this in the movie, you know, like way off in the background, you know, buried under, like, you know, 4 tons of dialogue and room noise and everything. I mean, it's hardly there at all, but still it was fun to do that.
Okay, now, earlier on, you and Lyle were both sort of under consideration to do the music, and at that point, you guys actually did some recording?
Right, yeah. They, you know, it was very tentative in both their interest and in our contribution as far as what we came up with. I mean, basically they wanted some kind of South American, Nicaraguan sound and stuff. And so Lyle and I went out there to L.A. and we kind of came up with this little tune that I guess we're going to play for you now. That's, we hired a couple session guys, Paulinho da Costa, who's quite a well-known percussionist, and Gary Foster. It's real short. It's just a little thing that kind of went behind this one scene where they're flying around in an airplane.
All right.
Pavesini Group with the title tune from their new album called Travels. Record, where'd you say it was?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, as in cream cheese. So, and before that, a tune that Pat and Lyle did for fun.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to.
With Paulinho da Costa and Gary Foster, is that right?
Right.
Gary Foster playing a bunch of, were those bamboo flutes or funny flutes? Or
he was playing sticks and tambourine.
Gary Foster?
Oh, Gary Foster. Yeah, no, Gary Foster was playing just real flute, alto flute.
Real flutes, but yeah. Several of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that record sounds great, man. Really,
thank you.
Really turned out well.
Yeah, I haven't heard it for a long time, so I'm enjoying hearing it myself.
So, okay, now we got this other thing queued up from this other film. This is something that's actually going to be in the film.
Right. This is what I was talking about before, where the Nick Nolte and this girl that he's hanging out with are kind of like in this dark room talking about their love affair, and like way off in the background you hear this, what the request was to write a little sort of jazzy pop tune. So I mean, I kind of like semi imagined what an Earl Klug tune would sound like, and this is what it ended up sounding like.
Klug by no, that's not it. Okay, so that was what's happening? That's on a radio? No, it's in a dark room.
That's in a back, it's like in a party, like on a record, like in another room on the other side of the building.
So who plays Nick Nolte's girlfriend?
I can't remember her name. Joanna Cassidy.
Joanna Cassidy.
She was in Blade Runner.
Oh, you know, she was in Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Which isn't the right name anyway. Blade Runner is actually called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Good book. Anyway, never mind. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. So, you're listening to WMFO Medford. I probably haven't said that in a week, so I should probably say it. So, let's see. So, you're touring with the band this summer for about...
It's about a month.
But it's a pretty active month, huh?
Yeah, it's the tour that I think everybody probably looks forward to the most, because it's in the summertime, a lot of outdoor places, some are quite large even, and something about the group tunes and the sound of the group that really goes with the outdoors in the summer. I mean, there's a definite connection there. Mm-hmm. So they're really fun, and a lot of people come out, you know, and it's neat to do those summer tours.
So you're playing the Common here again?
We're playing the Common.
5th of July?
That's right.
And also, for someone that might want to travel, you're playing out at Jacob's Pillow 2 days before that, right on the 3rd?
Right.
That should be nice out there, man.
Yeah.
That's a nice place. So, and then you're doing a tour with Sonny Rollins this summer, too, is that right?
That's
right. I heard you're going to Disneyland in Japan.
That's right. Now, for the last year or so now, whenever I've had the opportunity to do sideman gigs with Sonny, I've jumped at the chance, and it's kind of developed into almost like a steady band now, which is Sonny, myself, Jack DeJohnette playing the drums, and Bob Cranshaw playing bass. Although for this Japan tour, Alfonso Johnson's going to play bass mm-hmm. instead of Bob. But yeah, it's 9 concerts in Japan, and the first couple are this, it's kind of a famous festival in Japan, a jazz festival they have each year. A few records have even come from there called Live Under the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a package kind of thing that we're going to do a tour all over Japan with, and that group opens up, the Sonny All-Star Quartet, they're calling it, or something like that. And then it's Chick's Trio with Miroslav and Roy Haynes.
Oh, wow.
And then the new Weather Report. So it's like
that package is making
the tour.
Oh, that's nice.
So it'll be fun. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I mean, it's always for me. It's always, you know, the biggest possible thrill to play with Sonny.
Do you know if there's any plans to record that band? Or
well, you know, I'm always reluctant to play on records. You know, I mean, it's at this point, you know, I mean, I've had lots of opportunities to do all kinds of things with lots of different people, and I've just kind of made a policy of not doing sideman appearances. Since 1974 is when I made that decision, other mm-hmm. than bands that I was in and people that I toured with. So if something were to come up with Sonny, I would probably do it. And I'm thinking of even starting to do other projects as they come up if they're really good. But in general, you know, I don't feel real comfortable just kind of casually walking into a studio and just kind of playing with whoever happened to call me up. You know, I take playing real seriously, and you know, it's not something that I can just kind of do without feeling real close to the musicians that I'm going to play with. And in the case of Sonny's stuff, you know, I think it'll probably come up someday, but if it ever does, I really want to make sure that it's right. And also for me, I mean, I have the double problem in a way, in that my particular sound is very difficult to record and really easy to butcher. And so, I mean, I have to insist that I'm at the mix whenever it happens. And some people feel more comfortable about that than others.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, I'm open. I would definitely do something with Sonny if it were to come up.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about your sideman hat. What about this producer hat? Do you plan to, I mean, you co-produced or something other, you're mm-hmm. And also Bob Moses' really terrific new record, which just came out. That must have actually been quite a zoo. There's a lot of people on there. Was that logistically difficult? Or
It was a little bit. Fortunately, we had a fantastic engineer who does a lot of jazz dates. David Baker is his name. And he really had it together. I mean, it was complicated in that, you know, if it's a quartet or a quintet, you can pretty much let everybody have a couple tracks to themselves and figure it all out in the mix. But in this case, you know, there were times when there were 23 musicians playing at once.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was confused enough on that, on the other side of the glass. And on our side of the glass, it was even a little bit confused, too, just trying to keep track of everything. But I have to say that project was one of the most satisfying things I've been involved in a long time.
Let me just be a little bit more specific about it, since we have Bob Moses' new record. It's called When Elephants Dream of Music.
Right.
And it just came out on the Grand Vision record label. And he's going to be here, yes? When is this? Wednesday at 1. Bob Moses will be playing at the Willow, apparently, Wednesday night with some folks. I don't know who exactly. And he'll be here talking to us here Wednesday at 1 with Noah. That's good. He's terrific. And anyway, this is really a wonderful record. Everybody should go check it out.
Yeah, it really came out great. I mean, it's one of those things like where Moses had no money at all and really wanted to do another record. And he and I have been like, you know, best friends for years now, for 10 years. That's really wild. I mean, I joined Gary Burton in 1974, right when Bob rejoined. And so mm-hmm. we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary here pretty quick.
Yeah, man, I should have brought the trio tapes of you and Jocko.
Yeah.
That's a wild one, too.
Yeah. But, you know, I really feel like he's an incredible talent as a composer and just sort of musical visionary. And he had this idea of this project that he wanted to do. And so I said, okay, well, man, let's just go do it. And, you know, I put up some bread and it was enough to get it done. And then he kind of shopped around for labels, and Grammavision was interested. And so, you know, I ended up getting my money back. We got a great record, and
you actually got your money back.
Yeah, amazing. It's fantastic. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, it almost never happens where you have an experience that has absolutely no minuses. It was nothing but pluses. You know, it was a great record. It was the session itself was a session. It kind of reminded me of the 80-81 session, in fact, in that it was. It just seemed like nothing could go wrong. I mean, everybody had a blast. Everybody was playing really good and having fun, and it was just painless, you know.
What's that alto player's name? David Gross?
David Gross, yeah. He's a great player.
Beautiful player.
In fact, Moses seems to have a knack for finding guys who kind of are almost getting lost in the shuffle a little bit and really bringing out their talents. There's another tenor player named Doc Halliday who he uses, who's really a good musician, and a young percussionist named Joe Bonadio, who Moses has really worked with, who's real talented. Yeah, he's great. He's a groove. In fact, one of the reasons he's coming up here, I mean, in addition to do this little gig which he threw together, is that we wanted to do some playing, so we're going to have a marathon session all day tomorrow at this rehearsal space, just guitar-drum duo bash-out, which we haven't done for a while.
Yeah, last summer, in fact, I saw
That's
you
right.
do it. Okay, we'll play another tune from the new record here. This album, again, is called Travels, the Pat Metheny Group. It's a live double record set recorded at various stops along their tours last year in this country. And this tune is called Help. This
the Fields, called, the Sky,
yes.
Or Field and Stream, we call it now.
So this is actually, was this written as a feature for the Barenbau?
Well, yeah, Nana is such an expert at that instrument. We had written a tune called Ozark that featured it, and we wanted to come up with something else that showed off what that thing can do. And this includes a couple snatches that I've had floating around for a few years that I could never manage to organize into a tune. And so it ended
one's
up all
field,
coming
one's
together.
One's the field, one's the sky.
Right.
And it's, okay. Here it is from Pat Metheny's new album, Travels, The Fields, The Sky. The Fields, The Sky, the Pat Metheny Group, a loaf of bread and somebody's old newspapers. Nice. From Pat Metheny's new live double record set, I'll say one more time, called Travels. I don't remember the numbers.
ECM 123536.
Right. And if you're calling from Chicago, the number is... So let's see, what else we got here? Well, okay, why don't we talk about this thing? This is an odd thing, this the Perry Ubu.
Yeah. Well, about, I guess it's about a year ago right now, I got this tape in the mail. And, I mean, I get tapes constantly anyway, which I really enjoy. I'm glad people send them to me because I usually don't get much of a chance to respond to them or anything, but it's always fun to get stuff from people. But usually they're guitar players or bass players or piano players or composers or something. I got this weird letter saying that they had these people or this person. I didn't know what they were exactly. They called themselves Perry. I thought it sounded like a perfume company or something
or
like that.
Or some mineral water.
Yeah, or something, yeah. And they said that they had written words to some of our tunes, and they enclosed a copy of the words. And to just read the words is often the case. It didn't kill me. I mean, it wasn't fantastic, you know. I mean, they were okay, but they didn't jump out. And so I put this tape on, and I couldn't believe what I heard. And basically, what happened is I later found out that there was no indication of this from the letter, but there's these four sisters out in Los Angeles. They had taken our record into an 8-track studio, put the record on two of the tracks, which then left them 6 tracks to overdub their voices on, and they sang along with the record. And so here it is. I mean, you can check it out.
So which tune is this?
This is a tune from the American Garage album called Airstream.
The Perry sisters act up unwittingly at that point anyway, by the Pat Metheny Group. So that story doesn't end with that, right?
Yeah, we then used them on a few gigs last summer, and I expect that this summer we'll have them do a few of the West Coast gigs.
Now, also, it's my understanding that when you brought them to the stage, you were in L.A., right? And there are record company people in L.A. who immediately
jumped.
So what's the story with that?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, you know...
I assume they approached you, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I'd like to do something with them someday. It's just, in a way, I mean, I dig it a lot. I love it. And in fact, it's the ultimate compliment to have somebody like sing along with your solo and all that. But, you know, I don't know that that's exactly the direction that I'm naturally headed towards these days so much, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a group, and they're also really nice people and everything. But, you know, I'm probably a little bit leaning more towards a straight-ahead kind of thing more than ever, and that their thing is definitely more in the pop or R&B kind of groove, you know, which I'm leaning less and less in that direction as time goes on. So I don't know, you know. Also, I mean, you know, as much as I enjoy producing or doing all that stuff, I mean, it's fun, but I mean, what I really enjoy is playing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm reluctant to spend a lot of time doing things that involve non-playing. You know, I'd rather be playing, you know, mm-hmm. than anything. So we'll see. Who knows?
So since you mentioned that you're having an inclination towards more of a straight-ahead thing anyway, I have for a long time wished that there would be an outlet for that aspect of your playing, you know, in addition to the group. Mm-hmm. So there's this trio you've been working with off and on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's kind of an outgrowth of a relationship that has been going on for about 3 or 4 years now, that Charlie Hayden and I have become real close. And so happens that we're from towns in Missouri that are about 50 miles apart.
I know that.
Yeah, and we even have a lot of mutual friends. It's pretty wild. He's, you know, a good 20 years older than I am, but there are a few circles that intersect in our past, you know. And I love playing with Charlie probably more than any other single musician that I can name. There's a certain thing that happens when we play together that we both are pretty much in awe of. I mean, it's just, it seems like we can't hit wrong notes or something. It's like anything either one of us plays, it fits or something. So having played with Charlie, primarily with Jack DeJohnette, who was the drummer in the 8081 group, and then we also had a little trio together for a while and did a few gigs. In fact, we even played in Boston here.
Yeah, the legendary In the Snowstorm,
right.
Let's Call the Fire Department at Miles gig.
That's
that was
right.
Unbelievable.
That's right. But I was out in California a little while ago and really wanted to do some playing with Charlie, and one of my most favorite musicians and drummers is Billy Higgins, who happened to be in town at the same time. And so Charlie called up Billy, and we did two nights at this club, and it was really fun. And I'm planning probably for my next record to do a trio record with Charlie and Billy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in fact, we have a little tape here that we're going to play.
Yeah, this is serious, too. So hang on. This is one where you need seatbelts. This is actually just a blues, right? But it... Allegedly a blues. So
actually, it's based on, there's a tune on an old Miles Davis sextet record, or it's the Miles Davis quintet with Milt Jackson as a special guest, and it's a Ray Bryant tune. I think it's just called Blues, but that's what we were kind of thinking of.
Okay, so Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins recorded live. Where was it in San Francisco?
It's called, or it's in L.A. It's
in L.A.
It's a place called McCabe's.
Huh. Recorded, when was this?
Hello. December.
Oh, just December.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty recently. Okay, and Fat Metheny on guitar, and hang on your hats. Give me about 2 seconds. Oh.
Thank you.
Pat Metheny and Charlie Hayden, Billy Higgins, slightly edited.
Okay, Charlie.
So from L.A. last December, and you say you're going to make a recording with that self-same group?
I hope so, yeah. Maybe in September or October this year.
Okay, so we've got 87 different things here. So the record is out on Wednesday. The new Pat Metheny record called Travels, 12/35/36. Comes out on Wednesday. You're going to go on tour starting at the end of June, is
correct.
That right? For about a month.
Yeah.
And then the film that you worked on the score is called Under Fire.
Under Fire.
And that'll be out in October.
Right, along with the soundtrack album of me playing with the symphony and all that stuff.
Pat Metheny and the London Symphony. How are you going to be billed in this, do you know?
I think something like, you know.
Featured guest weirdo or?
Guest soloist. Something like
guest
that.
Guest soloist, right.
Yeah.
Guest Grammy-winning soloist. and you're going to the Japanese Disneyland with Sonny Rollins. Not many of us will make that one, I don't think. But you'll be on the Common July 5th. And thanks for coming.
Oh, boy, I really enjoyed it. Also, I got to say, I really appreciate WMFO for playing all that good music. I mean, you know, I don't know if the people in Boston realize how lucky they are to have a station like this that plays all kinds of different stuff. So it's, you know, having been all over the place, stations like this are few and far between, and speaking for a number of musicians, we all appreciate it.
Well, nice of you to say so. So in addition, I think we'll go out with another tune from the record, but before you split, it is Miles Davis's birthday the day after tomorrow, so why don't you... You picked out a couple of things by Miles that we'll play after you go, but why don't you say whatever you'd like to say about it?
Well, I mean, you know, I have to start talking about Miles, I mean, it's such a heavy subject for me because, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be playing music had I not heard Miles, and I think that, you know, that's true of practically every musician of my generation, you know, and even the generation older than me that's, you know, has any interest in jazz. I mean, it's hard to even fathom how many different ways he's turned music around and how many different times he's done it. So, I mean, for sure everybody should take a few minutes today and, like, say a little prayer and of thanks, you know, that we happen to get assigned to the planet at the same time that he did, because he's really unbelievable. And, in fact, the record that probably had the most impact on me and a number of other young musicians that I know was a live record called Four and More, which is the second part of a record that came out a little bit earlier than that, My Funny Valentine. They're both from the same concert. My Funny Valentine is mostly the ballads and the mellower tunes. Four and More is famous for its sort of relentless tempos and pretty much abandon in the form department, even though they were sticking to, you know, the basic length the choruses were supposed to go for. If you're going to play blues, they do just about everything in between those 12 bars that you could think of doing to a blues. And the cut that I've picked out is a blues called Walkin'. It's really unbelievable, especially the way Miles plays rhythmically on that particular cut.
Okay, well, thanks again for coming by, man.
Okay. Great.
If you can make it, we'll see you on the Common July 5th, and look for Travels in the Shops.
Yeah.
So we're going to go out with a tune. We don't have to say anything about this. It's a little faster than you might remember it. But anyway, thanks for coming.
Thanks.